Hey, y'all. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Hi, this is Kevin Amos, and welcome to this week's edition of Ebony Spectrum here on WRCT Pittsburgh. We have several different cuts for you, including In Black America with John Hanson. So listen to our various cuts that we've had that reflect what went on during this past week from different sources, and enjoy the program and give us your feedback. Thank you for listening.
This is a reparations update.
In partnership with historically black colleges and universities, Color Farm Media, the team behind the PBS documentary, The Big Payback, is bringing the conversation around reparations for black Americans to the forefront through a series of student-led debates. With inspiration from the 1965 James Baldwin-William Buckley debate, Color Farm Media and 10HKIS will hold a series of national reparations debates, which will be hosted at HBC universities and will branch off to include debates at other universities in the U.S. As part of the debates, student scholars will share their opinions on topics centered on restitutions for black Americans who the transatlantic slave trade has directly impacted as descendants of enslaved Africans. Look for times and venues.
A little more than 3 years after the 1619 Project was published in the New York Times Magazine, presenting a provocative examination of the American slave trade and its legacy, Nicole Hannah-Jones will debut her Pulitzer Prize-winning work on Hulu Thursday with a specific purpose in mind, to strengthen the case for reparations. We're going to have to fight for equality, whether we get reparations or not, she said. But I would rather we're fighting for equality having gotten some semblance of financial justice for the financial and other crimes black people have experienced. The Hulu series, produced under the Onyx Collective brand, carefully builds a case for reparations by providing a historical and contemporary analysis of the impact of slavery.
The College Board, which develops advanced placement programs that provide college credits to high-aptitude high schoolers, announced Tuesday it would be updating its newest AP African American Studies course after Florida rejected it from being piloted in the state. Framework for the course has been under development since March 2022. Still, the update will bring changes to it before the course's official rollout on February 1st. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' administration previously rejected the new AP course from being piloted in various high schools within the state, arguing in a letter it was inexplicably contrary to Florida law. However, the letter noted that the Florida Department of Education would evaluate the matter if the College Board became willing to come back to the table with, according to them, lawful, historically accurate content.
The Daily Show. Of course, between me and Leslie and Wanda, this is starting to look a lot like BET, I tell you that. Do not be shocked if you see those diabetes commercials. Ozempic! Black people love that song. You could have one foot, you still dance to that song. We don't even care. All right, of course, we have a lot that we need to talk about. So we're going to get right to it. So I'm sure many of you heard by now that a young black man in Memphis was pulled over by the police, and we all saw how it went down.
For the first time, we are seeing the violent arrest of Tyree Nichols. What began as a traffic stop quickly turned violent, as captured on multiple videos released tonight by the city of Memphis.
Officers are seen pulling Nichols out of the car.
I'm just trying to go home.
They use pepper spray and deploy a taser during a struggle. Then for roughly 3 minutes, officers are seen repeatedly kicking and punching Nichols while he was handcuffed.
As Nichols lay on the ground, bloodied and bruised, several minutes go by without any of the officers administering first aid. Nichols died in the hospital 3 days later.
Is it a shocking video? Yes.
Shocking. You know who wasn't shocked by that? Black people. I think that is a word we should throw out of our lexicon. Because the one thing we were not, you just see black people sitting around, can you believe they beat the shit out of another nigga on TV? Can you believe that? Because it's pretty commonplace for us. The only people who are probably shocked by this are people who haven't been paying attention. But for us, that's just a flashback. So Those videos are, like, so commonplace. It's hard to be shocked. That's like watching a porno and saying, he gonna stick that where? Ain't no way in hell that's gonna fit. I mean, I don't know. I'm just making a point. I don't watch porno. Let's stick with the story, all right? It is not shopping to black people because that is probably every black parent's nightmare. It's like, that's why we train our children to deal with police. We act like they going on safari or something. Like, don't make a sudden news, a noise. Don't make any sudden moves. Don't smile. Don't run. So you can't be shocked when the media spent a whole week prepping us for the video. They told us how violent it was going to be. To be real, that video got more promo than I did for this show. It's like, I haven't seen a TV show that anticipated since the remake of Night Court. They wasn't playing around. It was like they were rolling out a new movie release, brought to you from the people that bought you George Floyd and Rodney King. I can tell you what I did find shocking was how fast those cops got arrested. Yeah. Now. They got arrested so fast, they didn't even give us time to riot. I'm like, damn, what am I gonna do with all this gasoline? I gotta pour it back in the lawnmower. Because, usually it takes a considerable amount of time more. Like, usually when they tell us a cop got indicted, a reporter is wiping tear gas out her eyes. So it's just interesting because they did get arrested fast. And these cops got arrested so fast, I gotta wonder, why did all... There's something about them. That looks fast arrest worthy. Like, I... I can't put my finger on it, but I want to arrest them myself. I don't... I don't know, maybe they get their haircut at the same place. I don't know. I can tell you what did scare me is that no one could tell us what Tyree could have done to stop this from happening. I mean, usually you hear people saying he should have followed orders, but they gave him 71 different orders in 13 minutes. So not even Wendy's can turn an order around that goddamn place. And then they gave orders that didn't make any sense, like telling him get on the ground when he was already on the ground. Like, I don't know how they do it in Memphis, but where I'm from, the ground is as low as you can go. That's it. But, you know, it is a complex issue. And I know it helps me whenever I'm delving into a complex issue that affects black people, and I want an expert opinion. What I do is I turn to Fox News. I do. I learned how to make gumbo watching that show, too. So it's... It's the reason that I found out why cops do bad things in the first place. And it's apparently because people are so mean to them.
This is a direct result of all this defund the police stuff, right?
And if you vilify the cops, you'll get less people wanting to be cops.
These endless wars on police departments now, they have dissuaded a lot of good people from becoming police officers. That's a fact. They've had recruitment problems and they've had retention problems. You can look at the data like I can. And what happens is you wind up getting stuck, plain and simple, with just bad guys.
You would think he got his ass whooped, right? Like, But the great thing about it is I got a good guy from Fox to say they are bad cops. I got him to agree with Antifa, see? I've been here one day, and I'm changing shit already. It's going great. But there is one guy on Fox News, and this dude came up with something that I got to tell you, I really did not see it coming.
Looked like gang violence to me. It looked like what young black men do when they're supervised by a single black woman. And that's what they got going on in the Memphis Police Department. They've elected some or put some black woman in charge of the police force. And we're getting the same kind of chaos and disunity and violence that we see in a lot of these cities that are run by single mothers.
What the f*** is he talking about? So it is single black mothers that are the problem. So wait a minute. All of these cops, all of them, they had single black mothers too? And by the way, those are the images that came up when I Googled good cops. If Jason Whitlock proves anything, is that you do not have to be white to hate black people. And I can understand, how can we expect Jason to see the plight of black people when this dude can't even see his own? So, I'm D.L. Hughley. You know I was gonna do a dick on Comedy Central. You stop. All right, for more on this story, I'm going to be joined by Roy Wood Jr. What can you, hello.
You just disagree with the man. You had to bring his dick into it, then come to me.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Let's not let it between us. It's crazy. What can you tell me about the police officer that committed this attack?
Here's the thing, D.L. First and foremost, they're not just any police officers. They were actually part of an elite unit within the department with a special focus on violent crime. Elite unit.
That was elite?
Yeah. It was elite. It was elite. And the whole idea of an elite unit is already kind of weird, right? Like, shouldn't the whole police force already be elite? I mean, you already got guns. Like, you know what it's like? This is like when you get on the plane and the flight attendant tell you, oh, well, you're lucky today. This is one of our elite pilots. Well, who the hell? Who's flying this shit before, ma'am? But there's something even weirder about this elite unit, and that's in the name of this elite unit. They were actually called the Scorpions.
Oh, wow.
The Scorpion, the acronym. You know, the police, they love the acronyms. Right. And Scorpion stands for Street Crimes Operations to Restore Peace in Our Neighborhoods.
Ah,
Scorpion.
Okay.
And I don't know about you, D.L., but look, as a rule of thumb, no police unit should be named after a Mortal Kombat character.
Yeah. I agree.
You can't name no unit Scorpion, because once you give them a name like Scorpion, it don't matter what they're even there for. They're going to be violent with the shit. You can have a police unit that only does paperwork, but if you call them Scorpions, they're going to be swooping in and whooping ass with W-2 forms.
Agreed.
Anyway.
Agreed.
And that's the other thing, man. It's not that hard for the police to name a unit after something other than a deadly animal. You ain't got to name every unit after a deadly animal. It's easy. Just watch this. Securing neighborhoods alongside kind enforcement. That's peaceful.
Ain't that Snake?
Don't interrupt me. I'm still thinking. Give me a second. What about this one? This is peaceful. Yeah. Securing homes and rescuing kids with orderly, lawful functionality. That's good.
Shark Wolf.
Ah, damn. Okay. It's tougher than I thought. Forget acronyms. We can do one. We can do a police unit that is peaceful, kind. Gentle enforcement needs officers carefully inspecting downtown elements.
Don't you want us me to finish the week, man? That's genocide.
Okay, all right, well then, just forget the names. Here's an idea. Police got all these elite units.
Mm-hmm.
How about the police form an elite unit that's specifically trained to not kill black people? That's the unit. All-out unit, bro. Talking 6 months of boot camp, learning how to identify black people, mm-hmm. identify when our hands are up, identifying what complying looks like, all of it. I bet you could do that. If you did all of that, you could drop the killings of black people by as much as 20%.
We begin tonight with the fallout over the tragic death of Tyre Nichols at the hands of five Memphis police officers. Now, if you have a heart, what happened to the 29-year-old father, skateboarder, FedEx driver, and amateur photographer should outrage you. It should shock and disgust you, as should the so-called brothers who chose to behave like a little blue gang rather than as black men. But it damn sure shouldn't surprise you. What happened to Tyre Nichols was as American as apple pie. From the start, the European colonies in the Americas were designed to produce two kinds of people, subjects and citizens. And violence was at the center of it all. Even once they left Europe in the early 17th century, the colonizers of this continent remained the subjects of the European kings. Their citizenship existed at the pleasure of the monarchies of England, Spain, and France. Whatever your wealth or land holdings, if you were not the king, you were his subject. But with an ocean between them and the kings, their courts and their armies, these European lords in America increasingly yearned to live free of that status. And this vast, beautiful land wrested through extreme violence from the grasp of the indigenous. Every man could be a king, the citizen of a new republic, invested with natural rights and subjects of his own, his wives, his daughters, his indentured servants, and his slaves. But holding hostage thousands of African men, women, and children, strong and hardy enough to have survived the stress and disease of being shipped like kindling across the ocean in the searing hot sun of the plantation fields, particularly in the large numbers a plantation required, came with tremendous risks, the most pressing being uprisings and rebellions on plantations where white slaveholders were often quite outnumbered. And unlike the history that you learned in school, slave uprisings were constant from not long after 1619 right through the Civil War. And they happened everywhere, from New York to Virginia to South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, and Florida. No matter what the planters did, these Africans just wouldn't stop resisting and trying to free themselves, keeping the unpaid workers on the plantation and from violently overthrowing the system and maybe physically harming the people who claimed to own them required extraordinary violence. And so the planters created slave patrols, drawn from a social station below the planter class, almost all white, but every so often a handful who were black, who could control the enslaved, threaten them with whippings or death in order to keep them from running away, catch them when they did, and instill the kind of terror required to put down rebellions and keep black captives from rebelling as they endured rape, forced human breeding, physical brutality, and the selling of their children. In short, the planters invented the police. And the violence was the training. The violence was the point. And as the planter class grew richer and more determined to shed the last vestige of the kings, the taxes that cut into their slave-generated wealth, the situation came to a head. In Virginia, in 1775, here is a clip from the 1619 Project documentary on Hulu.
But when enslaved people continued to self-emancipate and presented themselves to Dunmore, he saw an opportunity to shore up his ranks by declaring he would free any enslaved person who agreed to fight against the colonists.
Dunmore issued that Emancipation Proclamation November 1775, and that Emancipation Proclamation infuriated white Southerners, because this building is supposed to symbolize white rule over blacks, and now the guy inhabiting that building has turned things upside down and is leading blacks against whites.
So you have this situation where many Virginians and other Southern colonists, they're not really convinced that they want to side with the Patriots. And this turns many of them towards the revolution. Is that right?
If you ask them, it did.
404 years later, the United States is still a land of subjects and citizens. I mean, it's more subtle, of course, but the basic structure is still the same. White Americans, unless you are poor or disabled, enjoy the full benefits of citizenship. You can generally vote without impediment, as long as you're not a woke student who prefers the convenience of a Dropbox. Your family has never faced violent reprisals for trying to go to school or to work. You can live wherever you want without fear of reprisal, rejection, redlining, artificially reduced property values, or your neighbors calling 911 because they don't believe you live there. Historically, America's citizens have felt free to lynch, to riot numerous times from Reconstruction through the 1930s, all the way up to January 6, 2021. They have felt entitled to overthrow the government when they don't like the outcome of an election. As a citizen, the police generally serve and protect you, your property, and your social comfort. Citizens feel free to scream at the police when they're pulled over or even to swing their fists at them. They get fed by the police after they gun down a church full of worshipers. They calmly surrender after committing a massacre. But those in this country who are still treated as subjects, Black folks, regardless of wealth or status, brown folks, AAPI Americans, poor white folks, non-white immigrants, and others who live at the margins of citizenship, live with the constant risk of housing and job discrimination based on your race, your social status, your hairstyle, or your last name. Higher interest rates and inadequate services in the zip codes you somehow always seem to get routed to. You might face discrimination at the airport and extra surveillance based on the outward manifestation of your religion. And then there is the often rude, dismissive, cruel, and too often brutal and sometimes deadly policing, which again was designed to control you and keep you socially confined to a status of inferiority and fear, regardless of how fervently you comply, how high you raise your hands, or how much you scream or beg or cry out for your mom. And it literally doesn't matter whether the police officer is white or looks like you, grew up like you, or could, without that uniform on, be you. It's not the race of the officer. It's the design of the system. Again, occasionally, some of the slave catchers were Black. Subjects endure the media and the National Guard, assuming they're going to riot at any moment, even though the cops who did the killing were arrested and charged. And even though it's the police who tend to break up Black vigils with tear gas and batons, not the other way around. Subjects face disapproving questions about what they did to cause their own death. Subjects fear for their children every day of their lives, even when by the grace of God they make it to adulthood, because they understand that at any day or time, they could meet up with the wrong cop on the wrong day and become the next hashtag. And subjects often turn their despair on each other or on their own communities. Those are the two Americas. And now you understand why the right doesn't want your kids to know this country's actual history or for you to know it, because they fear that if you knew, you might want to do something about it. In fact, you might even demand it. And joining me now is Mark Claxton, director of the Black Law Enforcement Alliance, and Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change. My friends, thank you both for being here. And, you know, I do want to start with you, Mark, because when I, you know, watched this video live with everyone else on TV, it disgusted me, but it wasn't surprising to me. And everything that I saw happening in that video sounded to me like it is the training. 71 commands, show me your hands, where they've got the hands pinned down. Things he couldn't possibly do, stop resisting when he's not resisting. Putting people in a position where you can't comply, and yet they're yelling into the body cam, comply. To me, that just proves the point that I was trying to make, that policing is about control. It's about putting a certain amount of fear into people. It isn't policing in a lot of ways. Your thoughts?
Well, first off, Joy, let me assure you that you had the proper reaction to observing on video a lynching. You had everything in context. And the feelings that you had watching that video, I had some of those very emotions as you were given some historical context to policing, the policing profession and this policing culture that we have. And it also gives some significant context to how we get to the point where you have Black police officers, if you will, buying in completely to the system, enough that they would engage in the subjugation of the very people that they came from, that they understood, the culture that they understand and come from. So it is very telling about the strength, the resilience, the stubbornness, the allure of toxic police culture. But it's also very important that we maintain this historical context that you laid out so brilliantly.
Let me ask you this, Mark, because the two things that to me I hold in my mind is that what happened to these officers in terms of them being charged immediately with crimes, having their brutality against this man exposed immediately, that's the way it should always happen. What I cannot imagine is five white police officers doing this to a black man and getting the video that quickly. What I cannot imagine is five black police officers doing this to a white person in Brentwood, you know, or in a part of Memphis that was affluent. I mean, the thing is, they understood not just what in their mind they could get away with, but they understood who they could do it to. In their mind, they could do it to him. Is that wrong to say, as somebody who yourself was a police officer?
There is quite clearly a dynamic involved in this particular case that makes it unusual, if you will. And I think a lot of people have not really addressed it fully because we've been so focused in on the barbaric nature of this lynching that we haven't considered and examined the role, the continued role that race plays in policing in general, and race is playing in this specific case. It is unprecedented, as far as I can tell, that you would have the victim be black, and that's common. But the multiple perpetrator officers are black, and the police chief, the commander of the police forces, is black. We have to examine that dynamic and these peculiarities, if you will, and keep them in context to the greater discussion about what happened to Mr. Nichols and what's been happening to communities of color, since the beginning of time.
And the reason why Mr. and Mrs. Wells, what happened to Tyree is so personal to me, is that five black men that wouldn't have had a job in the police department would not ever be thought of to be in an elite squad. In the city that Dr. King lost his life, not far away from that balcony, you beat a brother to death. There's nothing more insulting and offensive to those of us that fight to open doors, that you walk through those doors and act like the folks we had to fight for to get you through them doors. You didn't get on the police department by yourself. Police chief didn't get there by herself. People had to march and go to jail, and some lost their lives to open the doors for you. And how dare you? Act like that sacrifice was enough for nothing. You ain't in no New England state, you in Tennessee. Where we had to fight for you. Yeah. Yeah. And you take that position.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Now, of course, I wasn't satisfied with the response I got, but I expected that response. This is a racist, sexist country. And I'm a twofer. I'm not only a female, but I'm black. But I did it because I felt that in a multifaceted, variegated nation like this one, why should only white males be the president of the United States of America? I did it because I felt it was necessary to begin to get people thinking about someday, somewhere, somehow, a black person or a woman could be the president of this country. I knew they would laugh at me, they would giggle, because anytime anybody goes against a tradition, they tend to think of you as an oddball. But the catalyst for change in a society are always the person that has to take the insults and the misinterpretations to break the barriers down in the society. So I'm a very strong person, and I did it, and I don't regret it one bit. But I didn't expect to win. I really didn't expect to win, but I knew that I would be able to break away some of that feeling that only a certain segment of society should only be the group in our society to feel that they can be the head of the ship of state.
The late Shirley A. Chisholm, former Congresswoman, New York's 12th Congressional District. In 1968, Chisholm became the first African-American woman elected to Congress. She went on to represent Brooklyn for seven terms, from 1969 to 1983. In 1972, she became the first major party African-American candidate for President of the United States and the first woman to run for the Democratic presidential nomination. Throughout her career in Congress, Chisholm worked to improve opportunities for inner-city residents. She was a vocal opponent of the draft and supported spending increases for education, health care, and other social services, and reduction in military spending. She was a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus, a fierce advocate for women's rights and democracy, and a staunch opponent of the Vietnam War. Chisholm died on January 1, 2005, at the age of 80. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a tribute to Shirley A. Chisholm, In Black America.
Well, when I first went to the United States House of Representatives, it was a little bit difficult because they'd never had to deal with a black who is female in the House of Representatives. I was the first one to be elected to that position. I think the most difficult thing at that point, however, was the fact that they couldn't seem to understand how I was so terribly articulate and not afraid of anything or anybody. Because I guess in terms of the traditional historical patterns of how they perceive black women, you're supposed to be more or less subservient and almost bow when you see them in the chamber. It was very difficult for them to understand that I just was not of that ilk. But I'd like to say that within 3 or 4 months, actually, when they realized that I had potential, I had ability, and that I was very serious about what I was doing, that their attitudes changed, and I've never had any problems, you know, since that time.
Chisholm's leadership traits was recognized by her parents early on. She was the first African-American woman elected to Congress. She was a passionate and effective advocate for the needs of minorities, women, and children, and has changed the nation's perception of the capabilities of women and African-Americans. Born Shirley Anita St. Hill in New York City on November 30, 1924, she was the oldest of four daughters of Caribbean immigrants. In 1927, she and her sisters were sent to live with their maternal grandparents in Barbados. In 1934, she rejoined her parents in New York City. In 1942, she graduated from Girls High School with honors. Chisholm attended Brooklyn College and majored in sociology. She graduated with honors from Brooklyn College in 1946. She began a professional career at Mount Calvary Child Care Center in Harlem, eventually becoming director of a daycare center and later served as an education consultant for the city's child care department. She became active in local Democratic politics and ran successfully for the state assembly in 1964. She served for 4 years. In 1968, she ran for the United States Congress. She was elected from the newly created 12th District of New York City. She became the first African-American woman elected to Congress. In February 1982, In Black America spoke with the late Shirley A. Chisholm.
The issue facing black Americans in the 80s are the same issues that have consistently and persistently confronted us, the issues of employment. The fantastic escalation of the unemployment statistics in the black communities across this nation is almost incomprehensible. I've been traveling quite a bit, and in many of these communities, the statistics are as high as 40% of the employable black adults not working. This is a devastation of human potential in its worst form. And of course, once a man has a job, once a man has employment, it is very easy then for him to do the additional things in society that are necessary. He can get the kind of housing that he needs because he has the money to pay for the kind of housing. He's able to put aside money for potential educational training of his sons and his daughters. Employment continues to be the number one issue in the black community.
You mentioned today in your address a new women's movement. Could you expound on that further?
We are about the business of realizing that we have to harness the power of women in this country. Because it becomes increasingly important at this point in time to recognize that if we are going to bring about the kinds of changes in our society that deals with the human being, that deals with the potential of every child, whether it's a male child or female child, or whether it's a black person or a white person, that the female who has the compassion, more tolerance, I think, and more understanding, will have to become much more involved in the political arena. And so as I leave the United States House of Representatives, I'm not sitting down. I'm about some other business in this country.
Chisholm represented the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn, New York, serving until she retired in 1983. Also, she was a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus. During her first term in Congress, she hired an all-female staff and spoke out for civil rights, women's rights, the poor, and against the Vietnam War. Newly elected, she was assigned to the House Agriculture Committee, which she felt was irrelevant to her urban constituency. In an unheard-of move, she demanded reassignment and was switched to the Veteran Affairs Committee. Not long after, she voted for Hal Boggs, who was white, over John Conyers, who was black, for majority leader. Boggs rewarded her with a place on the Education and Labor Committee, and she was his third-ranking member when she retired.
Well, when I first went to the United States House of Representatives, it was a little bit difficult because they'd never had to deal with a black who is female in the House of Representatives. I was the first one to be elected to that position. I think the most difficult thing at that point, however, was the fact that they couldn't seem to understand how I was so terribly articulate and not afraid of anything or anybody. Because I guess in terms of the traditional historical patterns of how they perceive black women, you're supposed to be more or less subservient and almost bow when you see them in the chamber. It was very difficult for them to understand that I just was not of that ilk. But I'd like to say that within 3 or 4 months, actually, when they realized that I had potential, I had ability, and that I was very serious about what I was doing, that their attitudes changed, and I've never had any problems, you know, since that time. The main reason for my leaving the United States Congress is I indicated in that long press release that was sent out was that I desired to return to a more private life where I would have more flexibility of my time. That I had been out here for 23 years and I had not really enjoyed a private life. Like everybody else, I want to be able to have some privacy. And some 23 years ago, when I first entered the political arena, when I first went to the New York State Legislature, I indicated quite clearly that I do not intend to spend my creative and productive years ad infinitum in the political arena. But many persons forgot that, I guess because I had been in politics for as long as I have been, that they thought that I would stay there until, I guess, I was brought out or defeated. But I never, in my wildest dreams, wanted to spend all of my productive years in the political arena. That was in the statement. What is interesting, what people lift out of the statement. Now, with respect to the CBC and me, that has nothing to do with the CBC. Don't try to create any unnecessary situation here. It has nothing to do with the CBC. It's a personal decision of mine. Just like people make personal decisions day in and day out, that's my personal decision at this time. It has absolutely nothing to do with the CBC.
You mentioned earlier that poverty is a women's issue.
Yes, poverty is a women's issue because the majority of women who are in the lower economic bracket of this country are women. Most of the elderly citizens in this country, you go to the senior citizen centers across this nation, see the bulk of them are women because women live to a much longer age in America than men do for a lot of reasons. Have a lot of widows in this country who are really just subsisting. So when I say poverty is a women's issue, I mean that the issue itself
is an issue in which women are really disproportionately enumerated. It is definitely a women's issue. The women who are the heads of their families. We have many single-parent households in this country today, and most of those single-parent households are headed by women. And most of these women are not even making the, don't even have the poverty level income. So that is why poverty in and of itself today in America is, has really become a woman's issue. As we listen to the budget messages, and as we listen to the explanations given with respect to what the president, his advisors, and his cabinet are doing, that on the surface, they seem to make sense, because the president of the United States is one of the most charming political personages that I have ever met. But when you begin to really analyze and get your statistics in place and look at the different segments in society who are going to be benefited from these new regulations and rules, you see that the deception that is being perpetrated, in my humble opinion, on the American people is one that's giving them the impression that we are going to get this country back on an even keel, that it will be necessary for you to have patience with us, while at the very same time, day in and day out, people are suffering. People are not able to pay their mortgages because industrial plants, automobile factories are being closed up all over the country. The kind of income that so many of those elderly citizens who live on fixed incomes have is not permitting them to even enjoy some kind of life. They, in a sense, the president sometimes remind me as a person who is the captain of the Titanic. And as the Titanic is slowly going down, he's telling us to keep praying until it sinks. And that is the only analogy that I can really draw. I don't know if the people are tired, or if they have just about given up, or they feel that during the first year of the president's tenure, he has been able to get everything that he's asked for, so it's no sense, you know, trying. I don't know what it is, but the one thing that stands out in my mind, and I know I keep repeating it because I can't believe it, and that is, here is a president that indicated to us that by 1985, over $1 trillion, almost 60% of our money, the federal tax dollars, are going to be spent on the defense and the military. And we are not at war. This is a peacetime economy. And nobody seems perturbed about it. I remember back in the days of the 60s when we were talking about the Vietnam War, how people got perturbed and began to do something about it. And I wonder if it's because people are really overcome by his wonderful charm, or whether they're just too tired. I don't know, but this is frightening. And why it frightens me is because when we do suddenly awaken, it might be too late. One of the most dramatic changes in American society during the past decade has certainly been the phenomenon known as the women's movement. And that movement brought shifting social patterns to every level of life in America. It also has been a part of a greater humanist movement, which was rooted in the continuing struggle of those people in this country who had not been allowed to share in all of the rights and the responsibilities in this democracy. Many women were baptized in activist politics during the marches in Selma and Montgomery. And they began to work towards an end to discrimination against women. They began to fully realize that discrimination on the basis of sex was just as dehumanizing and just as morally wrong as discrimination on the basis of the color of one's skin. However, the discrimination against women has traditionally been much more subtle. Because women occupy every strata of society, this discrimination has also taken very varied forms. But when one looks closely at the history of our nation, one can discern patterns which demonstrate how we in this century arrived at such a distorted and contorted view of women and their capabilities. Our system of laws is based on English common law, under which women were essentially considered the property of men. The Constitution of the United States and the Bill of Rights were written for and by white men at a time when women and blacks had no acknowledged rights. They could not vote, nor could they hold property, let alone open a business or compete in the regular job market with white males. And we all know that the history books are filled with accounts of the bravery and the fortitude of men who blazed new trails, built our institutions, and introduced the industrial age. But you have to dig so deep to find the little that is written about the women who have also been a part of that history, who were equally involved with the settling of the West and the growth of our great cities, the women who were forced to take a secondary role simply because of their sex. And the writing of our history books, like the running of our government, was a role which had almost fallen exclusively to men. And so therefore, my sisters, black and white, the accounts that we have of women must be studied with these facts firmly in mind. And because the problem of sexism is a complex one, and not just limited to the job market, opening the system requires many different kinds of approaches. We have to realize that we must cease counseling our little girls that their adulthood will probably be spent in the home. We have to tell them and let them know that alternatives exist to the homemaker's life, where they will cook, sew, tend to children, and achieve any success in the workforce only vicariously. Now, don't anyone misinterpret what I'm saying to you. All I am saying is that there is a variety of alternatives for women to become involved in. Not every woman is married. Some women choose to be single. So we have to attempt to get away from some of the stereotypic thinking that goes back as far as the 18th century. We've got to try to do that. And Mr. Gray, don't laugh so heartily. The sad truth is that America is as racist as it is anti-feminist. That's right. And that both of these evils, if you will, indicate a large measure of anti-humanism.
What are the goals and aspirations of the Congressional Black Caucus?
The goals and aspirations of the Congressional Black Caucus continues to be trying to make life better for our people. But we have to face it right now. The Congressional Black Caucus is at a point now where we hardly have any allies. The moderates and the liberals who were with us through the years are all scampering and running. Not because they no longer have a commitment, want that to be clearly understood, but it is because the right-wing groups in this country, with their awesome control of financial resources and their strongly disciplined troops that they have to carry the message across the states, have caused the congressmen to be more cautious than ever in terms of backing those programs or supporting those issues which they know that the right-wing groups are against. And most of those programs and issues, of course, are the kinds of programs and issues that redound to the benefit of the poor and the minorities. So you find a number of congressmen not giving the support and not really building the coalitions that we used to have. Because after all, last November, these groups brought about the downfall of the most liberal, moderate, progressive senators that we had in this country, Birch Bayh, Culver, McGovern, and those gentlemen ran statewide. Therefore, the congressmen, many of them are feeling that if they could bring those guys down and they ran statewide, what could happen to them when they're running only in a little piece of the state? So what has happened? Political expediency, in a sense, has become the order of the day.
Are black Americans too democratic?
Black Americans too democratic? I'm not sure I understand the import
voting
of your question.
With the Democratic Party.
Oh, I see what you mean. I believe that black Americans are really going to have to take a good look at both the Republican and the Democratic Party, as far as I'm concerned at this stage of my life. I think what black Americans are going to have to do is to put themselves in a position where they can be a political force to be reckoned with and where they will be able to have the leverage to bargain with either of the two parties, where their votes will actually be necessary for either one of the two parties to win. Right now, the Republicans ignore us and the Democrats take us for granted. And the saying is we have no place to go, you see. I think we're going to have to really take a look now at what has happened and what is happening to us in this land. And at one time, I was very much against a third party in this country. I'm not as much against a third party, a third force to be reckoned with in this country as I used to be.
In 1972, Richard Nixon was president and running for his second term. The voting age had just changed from 21 to 18, and millions of new voters were expected at the polls. The Civil Rights Act was still new. The war in Southeast Asia was in full swing, as were anti-war protests, a beckoning women's movement, and the rise of the Black Panther Party. Also that year, on January 25th, Chisholm decided to shake up the mix. The brilliant former supervisor of the largest nursery school network in New York and congresswoman from Brooklyn, New York, announced her candidacy for the Democratic presidential nomination. She won 152 delegates before withdrawing from the race. In running for president, she became the first African-American woman to campaign for this nation's highest elected office, running as a candidate of the people. In doing so, she paved the way for others like herself.
Now, of course, I wasn't satisfied with the response I got, but I expected that response. This is a racist, sexist country. And I'm a twofer. I'm not only a female, but I'm black. But I did it because I felt that in a multifaceted, variegated nation like this one, why should only white males be the president of the United States of America? I did it because I felt it was necessary to begin to get people thinking about someday, somewhere, somehow, a black person or a woman could be the president of this country. I knew they would laugh at me and they would giggle, because anytime anybody goes against a tradition, they tend to think of you as an oddball. But the catalyst for change in a society are always the person that has to take the insults and the misinterpretations to break the barriers down in the society. So I'm a very strong person, and I did it, and I don't regret it one bit. But I didn't expect to win. I really didn't expect to win, but I knew that I would be able to break away some of that feeling that only a certain segment of society should only be the group in our society to feel that they can be the head of the ship of state.
Do black Americans realize their political clout?
I don't know if you can say if black Americans realize their political clout, because I dare say if black Americans realize their political clout, we wouldn't have what is happening to us in such a dastardly fashion. We have potential political clout if those of us who are eligible for registering would register and participate. Numbers in and of themselves don't mean a thing. You could have thousands of blacks living in a certain region, but yet almost powerless and impotent because they do not participate in the electoral process. If we want to truly realize our political clout, we will do that which is necessary to acquire the clout so that we can be a force to be reckoned with.
With you leaving the House, are you concerned that a chair will be lost at the Congressional Black Caucus table?
No, a chair won't be lost because I'll be replaced by another black from Brooklyn, so a chair won't be lost. I can assure you that the seat will definitely be going to a black person. I'm very, very happy to say that in the past 15 years, I have been very involved in helping to put together and strategizing in about 9 campaigns across this country, and 7 of the women won. Because women basically don't, they haven't been a part of the old boys network. And they feel that sometimes, because they're articulate, because they have a knowledge of the issues, and because they're popular, that they should run for political office. There's much more to running for political office. I hope to be able to teach them something about strategizing. Women as a whole know absolutely nothing about strategizing in terms of planning for a political office. So I hope to be able to do that kind of thing in different parts of the country.
Why did you decide to enter the political arena?
I entered politics by popular demand. I'm a professional educator. I have 3 degrees in the area of education, and I always thought I would stay in education. But I used to organize people, take them to budget estimate hearings and city council hearings. And I've always been a kind of fearless individual, afraid of nobody, speak up sometimes, I guess, when I was not supposed to speak up. And people like people that have nerve and guts. And I guess I exhibited that, and people said, you need to go into politics. And so that's how I got into politics, through the people. I've always been a people's politician, because I've been a maverick. I've been very independent. I've been somewhat controversial. I've been told every year some politician meets me and said, you're committing political suicide. Well, I've been committing political suicide for 23 years, and here I am.
The late Shirley A. Chisholm, former Congresswoman, 12th Congressional District, New York City. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
This is Dr. Ryan Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. All roads lead to Baltimore for State of the Black World Conference 5. The theme is Global Africans Rising, Empowerment, Reparations, and Healing. You know that by now because the mobilizing and organizing is on. But I need your help. I told you that already because we're behind. You know, we're 3 months behind, but we're going to do it. All things are possible if you only believe. Marcus Mosiah Garvey said, up you mighty race, accomplish what you will. And his son, Dr. Julius Garvey, is our honorary chairman. This is the crown jewel. This is the crown jewel. IBW is my legacy project. This is going to be an awesome conference. It's going to be amazing because you're a part of it. But I need your help. It was so gratifying today. I had a supporter call me. She was so excited. She said, I signed up today. Got my registration, and I also signed up my hotel room. Well, if you're in the greater Baltimore area, you may commute in D.C. and so forth. But if you're beyond that, obviously signing up for the hotel is an important piece as well. But we got a discount registration between now and March 31st. It is $200 for the registration. After that, it's $250 for registration. So we want you to register now. And that will help get us moving. We need that resources internally so we can continue to do the organizing and mobilizing. And there'll be more messages coming to you, more details coming to you. But right now, just go to the website, ibw21.org. We got people coming from all over the Pan-African world. This is going to be an experience you will never, ever forget. And of course, we're going to be talking about getting people organized as freedom rides, buses, and all of those kind of things as well. We got more coming. There'll be more bulletins coming. But today, go to the website, ibw21.org, and register and pick that one area You only can pick one, because we want you to have a quality in-depth experience. Pick that one area that you're going to focus on in terms of the State of the Black World Compass. God and the ancestors will bless you, and I will profoundly thank you for, in fact, signing up for State of the Black World Conference 5. All roads lead to Baltimore, April 19th through the 23rd, 2023. We just got about 100 days left until we get there. Thank you so much. Asante Sana. Thank you so much.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk?